I'm going to call this meeting of the Climate and Energy Committee to order. We have a quorum. Representative Carroll, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have.
And would you care to make a motion?
And I'd love to make a motion.
Representative Carroll moves the minutes from February 14th. Any discussion on those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Today we have one bill on the agenda from Chair Akam. Chair, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you in that role. I move that House file. I'm looking for the, 1656 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So Chair Akam moves that House File 1656 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I understand you have an amendment.
I do. There is a DE1 that I would like us to consider, and it's a DE. So if we can pass it, then we can just talk about the bill as a whole.
Okay. Representative Akam moves the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Akam. We're fine with whatever, so it's good.
Thank you.
Okay. Any discussion? Any other? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Yes. Chair Akam, I understand you also have an oral amendment.
Oh, yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's a slight amendment of just a year. So on line 5.22, if we can delete 2024 and insert 2023, this makes the funds available upon passage.
Thank you. Will staff read that back, please?
Page 5, line 22, delete 2024, insert 2023.
Great. Any discussion to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. Okay, Chair Akam, please tell us about your bill.
Let me move my water bottle out of the way here. Sorry about that. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'll be offering House File 1656, which establishes the State Competitiveness Fund. This work is building off the bipartisan effort started last session by Senator Senjum and Representative Long, who were then chairs of their respective climate and energy committees. The bill last year made it into the conference committee report, but as we all know, it died at the end of session. The bill last year was responding to the federal bipartisan infrastructure law, and then over the summer we know that also the Inflation Reduction Act was passed. These are landmark pieces of legislation that will work together to advance climate action and provide a historic opportunity for states to unleash clean energy and modernize our grid, to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, create new jobs, and drive down greenhouse gas emissions. Earlier this session, we had John Kelly from the Department of Commerce brief us on a sampling of the grant opportunities within the federal programs. These opportunities range from grid modernization and security to deploying renewable energy and investing in energy efficiency, and grants that are available to state, local, and tribal governments, our utilities, and institutions of higher education. All of this with an emphasis on serving disadvantaged communities within Minnesota. House File 1656 is designed to ensure that Minnesota gets at least its fair share of the federal dollars available. In simple terms, it does this by establishing a fund to be used for competitive matching grant opportunities within the federal legislation. The bill identifies eligible entities and recognizes that not all entities have the capacity to apply for federal grants, so it provides expertise and technical support to them. And finally, in order to provide transparency on the funds and the process, the bill commits to regular reporting. So we have a long list of testifiers who are going to help demonstrate the impact of House File 1656, so I will turn it back to Chair Kraft, and we can hear from our testifiers.
Thank you. I think our first testifier, or testifiers perhaps, are Commissioner Grace Arnold and Deputy Commissioner Michelle Grancy from the Department of Commerce Energy. Please come up, state your name, and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Kraft. And members, for the record, my name is Grace Arnold, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm really happy to be back here today and to be here with my Deputy Commissioner for Energy Resources and brains behind this operation, Michelle Grancy, to speak in support of Senate File 1622, which is our State Competitiveness Fund. So this bill would provide state matching funds that are required for multiple energy-related competitive and formula federal opportunities through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA, and the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA. This proposal is a vital part of how our state can achieve the goals in Minnesota's climate action framework as we continue down a responsible transition path for a clean energy economy. Minnesota can't afford to miss an opportunity to leverage the federal funding coming or that's available from Washington. This is a standalone version of the budget item included in the 2023 governor's budget for energy, and one that's been updated from last session where we reached bipartisan agreement on this critical program. I strongly believe that this remains a shared priority for all of us here to make sure that Minnesota can maximize the opportunities from the IIJA and the IRA. I'm really excited about this proposal providing grant development capacity in rural and disadvantaged communities in order to successfully compete for the billions of dollars in competitive funding. And I'm grateful that this bill provides the staffing capacity to apply for and implement the programs resulting from the new federal funding, as well as provide staff capacity at Commerce to provide technical assistance, quantitative analysis on climate and equity impacts for dockets and implementation of the statute. This is a historic opportunity, and unfortunately, we are behind in accessing federal competitive grants. With limited staff capacity to pursue these grant opportunities, we are simply limited in how many grants we can apply for and which we can apply for. Other states like Michigan have appropriated matching funds and additional infrastructure dollars, while Minnesota has not. But I'm really confident that we can fix that beginning today. There are over 20 competitive pots of federal money for billions of dollars that Commerce is positioned to compete for or to support competitive applications by entities that will directly benefit Minnesotans. Each successful program application will have staffing needs and some require a state match. So I'll highlight a few examples. There's a $5 billion grant program run by the U.S. Department of Energy to support activities aimed at reducing adverse impacts on the grid for extreme weather, wildfire, and other natural disasters. Large utilities must match the grants dollar for dollar, and smaller ones have a 33% match. State formula funds require a 15% match. A $5 billion opportunity from the Department of Energy to upgrade the grid and ensure reliability and resiliency. Awards to state energy offices would require a 15% cost share for that opportunity. There's $1 billion of Department of Energy funding to aid rural and remote areas, so that's defined as populations less than 10,000 inhabitants, with reliability and resiliency issues. There's $2.5 billion in revolving loan fund available in which the Department of Energy will serve as an anchor tenant and then enter into capacity contracts for new or upgraded transmission lines. There's a $3.5 billion smart grid investment matching program for the deployment of technologies that provide flexibility in responding to natural disasters, rebalance the electric system, facilitate the aggregation or integration of distributed generation, and support renewable generation. Awardees of those funds are required to have 50% or fund 50% of the project costs. So these are just a few examples of areas that Minnesota will need to be poised to be competitive for these grant applications. Other examples are hydrogen hubs, energy auditor and solar industry workforce training, and weatherization innovation. The predominant goal of this funding request is based in equity to ensure Minnesota broadly can be competitive with larger states and to ensure opportunities are accessible to tribes, schools, businesses, and other entities that could benefit from them. It's critical to address the structural inequities in access to resources so that this federal competitive funding can be accessed by all communities and not just the well-resourced. So I want to thank Chair Akam for bringing this forward and thank the many folks who have been involved in this work, the utilities, energy stakeholders, tribal leaders, labor leaders, and many of you who have helped work with us since last session to help make sure that we can be competitive with other states and maximize every federal dollar to bring into Minnesota. So I'll turn it over to Michelle to talk a little bit about what we've done so far so you can see the foundation that we're building on with this funding.
Commissioner Grancy, if you'd please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good afternoon, Chair Kraft, Chair Akam, and members. For the record, my name is Michelle Grancy. I serve as the Deputy Commissioner of Energy at the Department of Commerce. Here's a quick summary of our efforts to date around the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act opportunities, despite not having the matching funds or funding for a technical support team as of yet. The Energy Resources Division staff have been working around the clock, doing everything possible to help position our state to take advantage of these funds. In partnership with Minnesota entities, we have put in concept papers for over $700 million in competitive energy opportunities. We have submitted and received approval of the first year of the State Energy Security Plan, a revision of our historic State Energy Assurance Plan. We have submitted and are finalizing the contract for over $76 million in additional weatherization assistance program funding and $7 million in energy security and data access funding. We are currently finalizing the grid resiliency funding for the first $11 million to come to Minnesota, which requires that match. We've begun plans for energy efficiency community block grant program funding to expand the successful commercial property assessed clean energy program that will expand to more small rural businesses. We have been working on a plan for the revolving loan program as well. And finally, we are working with numerous other agencies, utilities, and governments and supporting their applications to the extent possible to leverage federal resources to the benefit of Minnesotans. The department continues to work on providing information on federal resources to all entities across Minnesota through email updates, webinars, our website, letters of support, and answering questions through our Fed questions inbox. With the passage of this bill, we stand ready to do a lot more. We can increase our response to the needs identified by stakeholders across the state. We have a dedicated team that is here to serve through this bill, and we heartily support the state-local partnership this bill will provide. I will close by simply echoing Commissioner Arnold's thanks to all of the folks in this room and across Minnesota who have worked on this bill, and I will be available for any questions.
Before we move to the rest of the public testifiers, are there anyone that has questions for our Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just waiting to hear in your comments maybe how many FTEs you'll need to implement this $156 million new program, and also if you could kind of walk through a little bit of that $156 million and where that will be going and how long that money can be used.
Ms. Grancy.
Chair Kraft, Representative. So out of the $156 million, $140 is for grant awards for eligible entities to match federal opportunities, minus up to 5% for the Department for Administration. There's also an additional $13.75 million in the proposed language for local grant development assistance, and again, with up to a 5% admin administration for the department. And when I say admin, I'm not talking what you might consider just admin. We're also talking technical assistance teams to be able to provide the technology support that many stakeholders have requested. There's $750,000 in the bill for reports and audits and $1.5 million for information technology to ensure that there's effective communication on all of the grants, the awards, and how the funding is utilized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, do you have an estimation of how many FTEs that would require? You said, I believe you said 5% of 140 million, 5% of the 13.75 million, and then the additional money that is delineated out, which is 750,000 and 1.5 million, the 1.5 being for IT.
Chaircraft, representative. So we estimated through the fiscal note that I believe you all have or will have shortly that it would require up to 11 FTE. That includes 4 technology experts that would have expertise around hydrogen, emerging fuels, grid modernization, engineering, and building sciences. A few grant specialists that would work on ensuring that the grants can move out quickly. We'll have a project manager and local educator to do that partnership work with the local units of government and the local appliers. We will need a federal requirements officer. These federal grants are pretty complex, and we learned through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that it's really imperative on the outset for folks to understand any flow-down requirements coming from the Department of Energy or others. And then we'll have folks focused on leading actual grant writing and that partnership piece around whether it's large-scale hydrogen applications or smaller disadvantaged community applications. There's such a wide variety of over, I think it's like 97 different competitive applications just in the IIJA alone, that this is what we anticipate would be needed in order to be effective.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
So we don't have a fiscal note, Mr. Chair. Do we know, are we laying this over then so that we can have a fiscal note and have that full discussion? What is the plan with this bill?
Yeah. So, Representative O'Neill, this is going to Ways and Means afterwards, and the costs of this are covered in the bill. There is a fiscal note on the way.
Mr. Chair, this is the fiscal committee that should be reviewing the fiscal note because this pertains to Department of Commerce, and we need the fiscal note here to be able to talk about the fiscal bill in the Committee of Jurisdiction.
Representative, I understand your point. I think it was aimed to be here. There was some questions, and the testifiers here are talking to the specific costs that are within this. So I think they're representing what's in the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note is very, I don't know if you've read a fiscal note, but they're very, very deep in detail. So it's really important that we actually have it in the Committee of Jurisdiction. And I would actually make a motion to lay this on the table.
Representative O'Neill, I have read fiscal notes, but thank you. Are you requesting a roll call?
Mr. Chair, I am.
Okay. At this point, the clerk will take the roll on the motion. The motion is for this to be laid over.
Laid on the table.
Laid on the table. And the chair will vote no.
Chair Akam?
No.
Representative Swedzinski?
Yes.
Representative Altendorf?
Yes.
Representative Bierman? Representative Carroll?
No. No.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Igo? Representative Mecklen?
Yes.
Representative Newton?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
Representative Igo is back.
Representative Igo, the motion is to lay the bill on the table. Do you vote aye or nay?
Igo votes aye.
There being eight nays, six ayes, the motion does not prevail. Okay, at this point, unless there are further questions for these testifiers, we're going to move to public testimony.
And in Ways and Means and in Rules.
We have a good lineup of testifiers today, so I'm going to tell who's up and who's on deck. And if you would keep your comments focused, aiming for two-ish minutes. First, we start with Derek Moe. On deck is John Tweeth. You would proceed and then state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Derek Moe, CEO of the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, or MREA. We represent all 50 of Minnesota's rural electric cooperatives who are leaders in the ongoing energy transition. We are rapidly decarbonizing our generation and working with our member owners, which other utilities call customers, to facilitate their adoption of distributed energy resources at their homes and businesses. The IIJA and IRA, each on its own, would have been the most transformative piece of federal energy legislation in my 30-plus years in the electric utility industry. Combined, they are a potent force to further enable rapid changes. Incidentally, IIJA and IRA are both packages containing only carrots, no new mandates, something cooperatives applaud, and a virtue of the bill being considered here. The legislation is important for getting the maximum advantage from these packages in Minnesota. It is important for putting rural electric cooperatives in a better position to take advantage of these programs and push our efforts at transforming the electrical grid forward while keeping electricity reliable and affordable. We appreciate the bill contains provisions to allow for assistance with grant writing. This is especially important as small nonprofit organizations, cooperatives have limited staff available to investigate and pursue these grants. We deliver electricity to areas of the state with fewer than two households per mile of line. The people purchasing electricity from us are also on our local boards and go to our local grocery stores with other people purchasing electricity from us. So being cost conscious is baked into our business model. Cooperatives are not hiring a bunch of people to pursue these grant dollars. So having access to grant writing assistance is needed to facilitate cooperatives competing for these dollars effectively. Two IIJA programs we have been particularly active in to date are EV charging stations along alternative fuel corridors and enhancing the transmission and distribution grid under the Grid Resiliency and Innovation Partnership, or GRIP, program. We partnered with the Minnesota Department of Commerce to submit a concept paper to the Federal Department of Energy under the GRIP program. If this application is ultimately approved, it would result in most of the state's rural electric cooperatives being eligible for a 50% federal grant for innovative projects on the electric grid. This one effort alone has the potential to bring over $200 million to our region, mostly Minnesota cooperatives, to enable over $400 million in projects we stand ready to pursue. Without these grants, these projects may not be feasible for decades or ever. Now we could implement them in the next few years, moving the energy transition forward while protecting reliability and affordability. Cooperatives view all potential infrastructure investments through the lens of assisting our local communities. These federal programs have the potential to bring such opportunities to our communities, and the bill before you here would help unlock that potential. We support this bill and appreciate the chance to testify and be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tweest, and then on deck is Greg Mast. If you could please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is John Tweest. I am the CEO and general manager of Arrowhead Cooperative up in northeastern Minnesota. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to share an overview of a small project that we feel fits the requirements of the Grid Resilience and Innovation Program. Arrowhead, as I just said, is located almost entirely within Cook County and is headquartered in Lutzen, Minnesota. We are a very small cooperative, and we've been at the forefront of technology and innovation. We are proud to be one of the first cooperatives in the state to build and operate a fiber-to-the-home network under our cooperative roof. So we are no strangers to the many challenges that northern Minnesota provides. One of the challenges we now face is one that we feel can be overcome with the funding available from the IIJA and GRIP program. As a small cooperative, the cost to achieve success with the project I will briefly describe is nearly impossible without grant monies to help support and bolster the reliability to our member owners. The Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa is a tribal community within Arrowhead's distribution system. It is served by a long radial transmission line, it's nearly 45 miles, and then followed by another long radial distribution line, which is another 25 miles. This distribution line serves tribal lands, their lodge, casino, school, and many other key infrastructure parts of their community. This line also serves a very busy U.S.-Canadian Customs and Border Office. These members have historically seen power quality issues due to the long radial nature of this distribution system. The project proposed in the Grand Portage area, which is a battery project, would provide the infrastructure necessary to ride through power quality issues such as blinks, voltage sags, and those are due to disturbances from outside events that are beyond the cooperative's control. This project could provide the possibility to disconnect and create a microgrid in the future during major disturbances and outages that could take a significant time to repair. It is our hope that Minnesota will help fund these projects, support our efforts to provide the reliable infrastructure needed to support our tribal community. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on this important project, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you. Next we have Greg Mast, and on deck is Angelie Baines. And we'll take questions for all the testifiers at the end.
Good afternoon, Chair Kraft and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Mast, and I am the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, or SEEM as we are known. And we are an industry-led, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization representing the business voice for clean energy in Minnesota. Today, I'm here to testify in support of House File 1656 as amended, which will create a state competitiveness fund to ensure Minnesota is best positioned to pursue federal dollars from both the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, IIJA, and the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA. Minnesota needs this state competitiveness fund, which will provide matching dollars, enabling entities to secure federal funding through the IIJA and IRA. It is imperative resources are set aside to assist a myriad of entities with match requirements. This fund will also ensure state agencies and regional development commissions have the resources necessary to provide smaller jurisdictions with their critical expertise and technical assistance, which will result in stronger grant proposals. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for Minnesotans. There are literally billions of federal dollars that will be distributed across competitive grant applications. This includes funding for items such as regional hydrogen hubs, upgrading the electrical grid, piloting emerging clean energy technologies, researching the extraction of rare earth elements vital to the clean energy transition, as well as training and upskilling the next generation of clean energy workers. With 58,000 Minnesotans employed in the state's clean energy sector, the industry is a significant and growing part of our state's economy. Minnesota's educated workforce, concentration of Fortune 500 companies, and clean energy policy leadership has uniquely positioned the state to become a global hub for clean energy technology development and deployment. The creation of a state competitiveness fund will help Minnesota harness this potential. So in closing, SEEM urges your support of House File 1656 as amended, and we ask that you allow Minnesota to meet this historic opportunity to secure federal funds and investment. We'd like to thank Representative Acom for her leadership and for bringing this bill forward. And we do look forward to working with all of you and other stakeholders to ensure that we lead in opening up an inclusive and prosperous clean energy future here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next is Angelie Baines. Please, and then on deck is John Thorson. Please welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Wonderful, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Anjali Baines, and I lead the Energy Access and Equity team at Fresh Energy, a 30-year-old clean energy advocacy nonprofit based in St. Paul. We are pleased to support House File 1656 as amended and thank the bill author for bringing this competitive fund forward. Fresh Energy has been closely tracking the influx of federal funding for clean energy that has been announced over the past 2 years, which are poised to quickly decrease our country and state's carbon emissions and usher us further along the path of clean energy and a healthy, efficient, electrified economy. However, a crucial missing piece remains in providing state matching funds, which this bill would help fill in. A state competitiveness fund will not only help to ensure that federal funds are being fully leveraged, but also provide a more level playing field for entities to receive these funds, especially those who may otherwise find it hard to find other sources of funding quickly enough to apply for the competitive clean energy opportunities available. We are also pleased that this bill includes funding for technical assistance, another key piece of the puzzle to ensuring an equitable transition to a clean energy future in Minnesota. Such funding will enable groups unfamiliar with clean energy solutions or those with limited staff capacity to still be able to learn what's possible with this influx of federal funding and then apply, reaping the benefits of a cleaner, healthier environment and economy. We look forward to continuing to work with lawmakers, agency staff, advocates, and others on how to best meet the unique moment upon us with this federal clean energy funding, including other opportunities to expand and enhance these federal investments. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Next is John Thorson, and on deck is Daniel Lightfoot. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm the Legislative Director for LIUNA Minnesota and North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who proudly build and maintain our state's transportation, water, energy, and building infrastructure. LIUNA is committed to a clean energy transition that makes our state, our industries, and our workforce stronger, more prosperous, and more competitive. We're also committed to making sure that energy continues to create high-quality, family-supporting jobs for Minnesotans. When it comes to the clean energy transition, LIUNA has put forward a simple principle, and that is clean energy jobs should be just as good and just as available to local workers as the conventional energy jobs that have provided family-supporting employment for generations of Minnesotans. The bill before you, House File 1656, does this by unlocking funds and maximizing Minnesota's ability to draw from the federal funds and programs available through the IIJA and the credits in the Inflation Reduction Act. It will support development of innovative energy technologies, including advanced nuclear, battery storage, carbon capture and sequestration, direct air capture, and renewable hydrogen, among many others. It will also support development of domestic clean energy supply chains, from production and processing of raw materials to the manufacture of key clean energy components and technologies right here in Minnesota. By strengthening our energy infrastructure and accelerating innovation, the IIJA funding has the potential to bring thousands of jobs while at the same time reducing costs for consumers in Minnesota. We could be very well positioned to capture the competitive federal funding based on our already strong policy leadership, strong utility infrastructure, and skilled workforce. This bill also adds the flexible financing to make our proposals for Minnesota more competitive to compete for these funds. I can think of no expenditure the state can make in this area that has the potential to deliver a larger direct return on investment than the proposed competitiveness fund in this bill. Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Chair Akam for bringing the bill forward. House File 1656 is essential to ensure that Minnesota can capture and maximize our fair share of federal energy infrastructure investment, and we believe this bill will unlock investments that move our state forward, will create and maintain thousands of good-paying union jobs, and will drive economic growth in every corner of the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Daniel Lightfoot, followed by Kent Sulem. Welcome to the committee again, Mr. Lightfoot. Would you state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Well, Thank you, Chair Kraft, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 837 of the state's 854 cities. And I just want to thank Chair Akam and members of the committee for hearing this bill, House File 1656. At the outset of this legislative session, the League set out and discussed before this committee and several other committees two very key goals to in order to maximize the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act funding and the resources through the Inflation Reduction Act, one being ensuring that the legislature passes the requisite state matching funds and assists sub-applicants, including cities with non-federal match requirements for those programs, and two, provide state resources for technical assistance to help especially small or less resource cities identify and apply for grants at both the state agency level from these funds as well as the federal agency level. And pleased to see that this bill does both of those things. So I want to thank Chair Akam again for her leadership on this bill. This particular model of bill has become sort of a model for the other areas in the IIJA and IRA that require non-federal matching requirements. The state of Minnesota is a small city state. We have 700 plus Minnesota cities that have a population of less than 4,000, meaning generally you have a city clerk and a handful of other staff that are generally not very well versed in filling out, you know, multiple hundreds of pages of RFP proposals with state and federal agencies. So really pleased to see some direct technical assistance for not just filling out grant applications, but also the identification of what's out there with close to 400 new funding streams between the two of these federal pieces of legislation. There's a lot going on. So really appreciate the resources and the scope of this bill. And thanks again for Chair Akam for authoring this. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Kent Sulem, followed by Chris Dufferin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem, Director of Government Relations and Senior Counsel for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. Like those you've heard before, we too are here to offer our sincere thanks and support for House File 1656, in particular as it applies to providing technical assistance to the small utilities that we represent. As a matter of fact, we actually brought on a staffer just before the end of last year who has some grant experience, and so now we're eager to combine efforts to show what we can do with our efforts, partnering up with the rural co-ops and making this program a success that will help us also go a long ways towards meeting resiliency needs and innovation needs to hopefully get us towards 100% sooner than we're mandated to do. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, Chris Dufferin, followed by Zach Martin. Welcome to the committee again. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Kraft. Members, Chris Dufferin with the Center for Energy and Environment. The IRA bill and the IIJA bill are both incredible opportunities for Minnesota. Many of those opportunities, many of the grant funds have, particularly the formula-related funds, have started to roll out in Minnesota, but many of the competitive opportunities remain ahead of us. States with that have gotten out in front of us have internal operations that are ready to go, that have matching funds that are ready to go, and Minnesota is frankly just a little bit behind. This bill takes care of that. This bill puts us on track to be competitive with other states. So earlier in session, I came before you to talk a little bit about the energy efficiency opportunities that were in this bill, code advancement, home energy retrofits, public school retrofits, pools of funds to leverage other private funding so that we can finance a lot of these improvements. These are some of the opportunities in IIJA and the IRA bills. All of these energy efficiency improvements end up lowering customer bills. They increase the resiliency of our buildings. They improve local jobs. They add local jobs. And they lower costs for ratepayers over time by just addressing the demand side of our energy system. Some of the things I didn't talk about are even bigger opportunities in these bills, things like industrial decarbonization, a sector that's going to be very hard to decarbonize, but there's grant opportunities for grid resiliency, which we need as we move forward in Minnesota, and carbon capture, which again is going to be critical for some of those more difficult to decarbonize sectors of our economy. The other part of this bill that provides grant development support, I think, is incredibly important. As you've already heard today, our regional development commissions, our municipal utilities, our cooperatives, our Indian tribes, all need to compete for these funds, and they're going to be up against much larger cities and other communities all around the country competing for these funds. And having this kind of assistance is going to be critical for them to just put together the grant proposal in order to be competitive. So just to sum up, in order for Minnesota to be more competitive, in order for us to capture more tax dollars that we are all putting in to Washington right now and bring those back, and to invest in a more efficient and resilient infrastructure, this bill will really help move us forward. So I want to thank Chair Akam for bringing this forward, and thank you all today for your time.
Thank you. Next we have Zach Martin, followed by Annie Humphrey. Please welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Kraft, Representative Akam, members of the committee. I am Zach Martin. I'm the Manager of Government Affairs for Minnesota Power and Elite. Minnesota Power has had the privilege to serve northeastern Minnesota for well over a century. We are a unique investor-owned utility. We serve about 145,000 residential customers, some of the largest industrial customers in the nation, and also some of the poorest counties in the state of Minnesota. Every day, we work to provide safe, reliable, and affordable energy to all of our customers. So with that in mind, we support House File 1656 as amended, legislation which will create a Minnesota State Competitiveness Fund to provide state investments into energy projects eligible for federal IIJA and IRA grants. We certainly agree that Minnesota should position itself to attract as many federal dollars as possible, help mitigate the cost of projects, and support electric industry transformation. Minnesota's financial support is critical in these highly competitive federal grant applications. This year alone, Minnesota Power is planning to submit several applications to the U.S. Department of Energy and compete for federal funds on a nationwide basis, trying to bring as many funds as we can into the state of Minnesota. These projects are critically important for our region, and we also plan to use unionized labor during construction and ongoing operations for each. The projects we're working on include an upgrade in transmission capacity and capability, an energy storage pilot, and an industrial decarbonization pilot. Our goal is to reduce the overall cost of these projects by seeking state and federal support. Today's legislation would help us achieve that goal. So with that, we certainly appreciate the collaboration, appreciate the work by Chair Akam, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you all today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I know that you said that you weren't going to take any questions, but my understanding is this is Mr. Martin's first time testifying before the committee, so I would like the chair's indulgence to be able to haze him for a few minutes. Is that okay?
True.
Mr. Martin, is that okay with you?
That would be just fine with me. I can't wait.
If he's if he's volunteering, then you've kind of taken out the fun of it. So I guess I think I speak for every member of the committee that there's three pieces of information we need to know, like, right now. Number one, if you could just tell us the exact number of customers that are in your service territory down to the exact amount, the exact number of square miles of your service territory, the different types of voltage requirements on each segment for each one. And we need that now, Mr. Chairman, right? And a fiscal note. And we need a fiscal note.
I think Representative Garofalo, I think the fiscal note is on the way, but you, Mr. Martin, you're welcome to ignore the questions if you'd like.
Well, Chair Kraft and Representative Garofalo, I'm happy to get to you that information as soon as I can after the committee has adjourned. Happy to do so.
All right, we're going to move on.
Thank you.
Next, we had Annie Humphrey, but I don't believe she's here, and so following Annie is Brendan Jordan. And if you would come on up, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And I promise not to allow Representative Garofalo to ask any questions.
No hazing.
Mr. Chair, if Representative Garofalo would like to haze me as well, I'm always up for that. So, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Brendan Jordan. I'm the Vice President of Transportation and Fuels at the Great Plains Institute. The Institute seeks to transform the energy system for the benefit of people, the economy, and the environment. We are very pleased to stand here today in support of House File 1656. This is a very important bill for Minnesota. As many have said, these two paired pieces of legislation, the bipartisan infrastructure law and the IRA, together represent the biggest piece of climate legislation that's ever been passed at the federal level. But in some ways, that passing it, even though it took decades to get there, was the easy part. Implementation will be the hard part. Implementation is critical. And I think this bill goes a long way towards addressing the implementation challenge and making sure that Minnesota has the resources to effectively implement both this federal legislation and our increasing focus on climate at the state level. There's a lot of exciting elements here, looking at the opportunities for the state, so it's hard to know where to focus, but let me just identify a few programs that are priorities for the Great Plains Institute. We're very excited that Minnesota could have the opportunity to compete for hydrogen hubs. We're very excited to see increased technical assistance resources for local and tribal governments. We're very excited to see the opportunity to have state matching funds for expanded electric vehicle charging. We're also very excited about the possibility of resilience investments like solar plus storage and resilience planning. Above and beyond that, we see huge opportunities in industrial decarbonization, carbon capture and storage, natural and working lands, carbon removal, and other strategies. In closing, the bipartisan infrastructure law and the IRA do assure that lots of new investment is going to take place, but they do not ensure that it will come to Minnesota. So proactive steps like this are what we need to make sure that we get our share of the funds, desperately needed funds, to move this work forward and reap the benefits. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Chair Akum, for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you. Before we move to questions from members, is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify on this bill?
And be hazed by Representative Garofalo? Yeah. And risk hazing, maybe. Sorry.
Seeing none, we'll move now to member questions for the testifiers as well as, I think, on the bill. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we don't have a fiscal note, I'm wondering if the author of the bill, if Chair Akum, could explain 6.3 and 6.4 in the, yes, in the DE.
Chair Akum.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for the question. Let's see.
6.3, 6.4.
Yep. From clause 1 and 2. Maybe what we can do, since we do have Assistant Commissioner Grancy, she can come and help us. And so it's talking about, do you have the legislation?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Ms. Grancy.
So Commissioner may transfer money from clause 2 to clause 1. If less than, it's the small grants. So it's in reference to the $75 million that, or $750,000 that is in subdivision 7, no, that It's the small grants, and I'm struggling to find where that is at the moment.
I could recognize House Research, Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Bob. Mr. Eliff.
Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding Representative O'Neill's question correctly, it seems to me that that those two lines are directing that if not all the money, the $13,750,000, which is going for technical assistance and grant development assistance, is used by June 30th, 28th, that remaining money becomes available to be used for grant awards themselves to Minnesota entities who are applying.
Yeah.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so the I thought this was money for the commission itself. So this, Mr. Eliff, this isn't for the commission itself, but it's the money for the grants that if it's not expended by 2028, it would go, it would fold back into where?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, this money is for technical assistance and grant development assistance, and if the full amount is not used by that date, it would then be made available to be used for state matching purposes that they're going to eligible entities that are making applications to the federal government for grants.
Okay. Now, okay, got it.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are all really helpful things that would have been in the fiscal note. Okay. Do we know when we're getting the fiscal note, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Could fiscal staff be able to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, Ashley Enghouse, fiscal, it's almost done. I can't give you an exact date.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it would be really nice to have it in here to talk about it. I'm wondering if the commission, the commissioner could talk to something else really quick, because I was kind of adding stuff up, and the Department of Commerce said they needed 11 FTEs, and when I added up quick the percentages of 5% in those two different categories, it came up to almost $7 million. And I'm just wondering, of that almost $7 million, how long that those funds are available, because typically 11 FTEs cost about $1 million, $1.2 million a year, depending on what kind of FTE it is. And I'm not quite sure how many years we're allowing this expenditure to be going forward.
Ms. Grancy?
Chair Kraft, Representative. So the financial piece of it is for 4 years for the department to really be able to get out there, provide the services, get the grants out to the local units of government, et cetera. So it is fully loaded. And again, this is an up to estimate, right? Would be about $1.8 million for the 4 years, per year for 4 years, which does bring you up to about the number that you reported.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 1.8 for 11 FTEs, so that's higher. Typically, we do 100 million or a little, sometimes 140 per FTE. In the 10 years I've been here, it's been sort of around that number. So it's considerably higher than that. Can you explain why we're paying much higher than that per FTE for the 11?
Thank you, Chair Kraft. So again, I can bring the exact numbers back to you. But for instance, with the technology efforts or the experts of technology, we do anticipate needing high level engineers and others that really are experts in their field to be able to provide those services at the level that's needed in order to apply for Department of Energy funds. But we can certainly break out each and every FTE for you and provide that information in a more detailed way.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, all these things would be in the fiscal note had we had that. So that's great. So it comes out to about $164,000 per FTE, which is pretty high for typical FTE. And you're saying that this money is enough for 4 years, but how long does this appropriation, how long is this appropriation available for, the $156 million? How long is that appropriation available before it does it cancel back to the general fund, or is this an open appropriation?
Chair Kraft?
Yeah, Mr. Grinsey, I can also address that to House Research if you'd like.
Go ahead, Mr. Elaff.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, line 2.7 of the bill says that the money remaining in the account will be available until June 30th, 2034.
30. Chair Kraft, can I also just note that it is a fully loaded amount, not that each of those individuals are making that amount. Right, so there's IT expenses, there's rent, there's all of those other components that come into that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fully aware of how FTEs work and how they're calculated into fiscal notes. Thank you. So this money is appropriated through 2034, but the FTEs are only calculated for 4 years. So how are we managing the gap?
Ms. Granson.
Chair Kraft, Representative. So the anticipation is that in the first 4 years, we will need to be working directly with all of those entities that are applying, establishing the grant and matching funds. A large majority of those funds are only available over the course of the next 4 years, but then once the grants are received, then they'll have 5 to 7 to 8 years. And so we would anticipate that our need at the state would reduce down significantly, because then it's more of a project management, ensuring effective use of funds, reporting out on the use of funds, rather than providing the direct technical assistance that is needed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. So your FTE count of 11 would drop to what then after 4 years?
Ms. Grancy.
Representative Kraft, Chair Kraft, Representative, I don't have that in front of me, so I would have to double check that, but I would anticipate that that would drop down to maybe 2 or 3 versus the 11, anticipating that there's a lot that we don't yet know, and what opportunities, how they will run, their course. I will note that I apologize that you don't have the fiscal note. We did submit it to the LBO yesterday, but we're all on a short time frame. I know they're working hard at this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
It just punctuates the fact that we need fiscal notes, and if we don't have them, we really shouldn't be having a fiscal committee hearing about a fiscal bill, particularly when it's a $156 million bill that can be expended until 2034. I think it's important. You know, we could have just laid this over and then talked about it next hearing and had the full information. Would have been a lot easier, a lot cleaner, a lot easier to follow. So I really urge you in the future to just wait and have it in the next committee hearing. I know you have a full agenda. We all do. We're just doing all this at breakneck speed, a freight train is running, but I really ask you to please take a breath and just slow it down just a little so that we can have all the information available to us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swatinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a general question, too. You know, looking at the bill, it appears there's some oversight, but it appears that the bill doesn't utilize a legislative auditor. Why are we not using the legislative auditor to audit these programs, how the money is being spent within these programs, and why an independent one?
Jerry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I think that we went this route after consultation with some of the agencies, and I'm certainly open to suggestions that you might have that might be better. I think this was just a path we chose. If you have an alternative path to suggest, I'm certainly happy to talk with you about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Akam. You know, I think, you know, as a legislative body, Representative O'Neill made some really good points in the fact that, you know, having legislative oversight, having committee oversight when it comes to particular areas, you know, I would recommend that, you know, after this potentially travels to Ways and Means that you actually re-refer it back here, so that after the fiscal notes there, so that we can bear it out and kind of look at how some of those processes would work within the hiring process, like are those 9 or so, 11 or 12 or however many employees, are they considered temporary when they're hired? Are they?
Chair,
I'll refer to Commissioner Grantley.
Chair and representatives, so when individuals are hired, and I'm not HR, so just to keep that in mind, my understanding is that we can do temporary unclassified appointments up to 3 years. After that, due to the ways things are constructed, they need to be permanent positions. And so that doesn't mean that obviously if funding ends, that impacts the position, right? There's no funding for it. But they are not, they won't all be temporary employees. Some may be hired as temporary employees and some may not be.
But, you know, just thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just keeping that in mind, it seems that it would be wiser to you know, obligate for a three-year period so that you could get by with, you know, having those temporary appointments rather than go through the process of having kind of a mixture of both, you know, just from the process. And, you know, I think when we're looking at a bill that potentially will spend money 10 years into the future, you know, we can't tie the hands of future legislators. And, you know, we don't know what that's going to mean. You know, it's very concerning and where the, I mean, even from the federal government standpoint, where this money came from, I mean, that should concern us all very deeply. You know, I've heard over and over from Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives in this room, well, it's just free money. We just have to spend it. Well, that's very concerning, folks. You know, we've got a mountain of debt, and this helped pile it on. And, you know, we're going to spend real money to do things in our state that, you know, could be argued whether it's good or not. But it came from nowhere. And, you know, that should be very concerning to a lot of folks. And, you know, one of the things that I'm also just asking, and just from a standpoint of, you know, how much legislative oversight will there be during this process? It seems that we give the department a lot of power when it comes to potentially funding both sides of the coin. So when we have dollars going out, we're going to be giving them to organizations so that they will have the ability to go out and hire people themselves to write grants that spend state money. So it's not like these dollars just come from nowhere, you know, from an outside group, disadvantaged group, whatever that might be. You're going to give money to some group so that they can hire someone so that they can fill out paperwork that you're going to help them do. It's all well and good, but it seems like, you know, we could have a lot of back padding and a lot of, here, why don't we, you know, steer things this way or, you know, a lot of that. And that's, you know, that's where bad things happen when it comes to government. And the opportunity for fraud, we've seen it in a major way with feeding our children. And, you know, I'm concerned that we could see a repeat of that just, you know, instead of, you know, feeding our energy grid in the same manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski. The department is going to be required to send reports to the minority and majority leads in both bodies on an annual basis. And on page 5 of the bill talks a lot of detail, what needs to be, how many grants were awarded, what the number of personnel hired, talks about the technical assistance. And there's a list of information that is being asked to be reported on an annual basis. And I don't know if Commissioner Grancy has anything else to add to that.
Commissioner Grancy.
Chair Kraft. I would just add that with the Department of Energy and the way that my understanding how the bill was written, it will require the department to reserve funds that then the Department of Energy already has a very intensive competitive process that would be selecting those entities that would be awarded, and then the reservation or the match would then be provided. So the department isn't going to go and say, you take $5 million, you take $5 million. It's not that, you know, we have extensive requirements as to how we go about our granting process. And on top of that, the Department of Energy would have extensive requirements as well, similar to multiple other federal programs that we currently administer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the testifier, you know, speaking of that, obviously the department will have reports that are due up the chain as well. So not just reports that are due to us and to grantees, but also to the federal government. Where do those staff come from?
Commissioner?
Chair Kraft, Representative, are you saying, could I ask just a question of clarity? So when it comes to federal programs in which federal dollars come to the state, we do extensive federal reporting already and would add that in. When it comes to federal reporting required of the entities that, say, in a competitive space have applied for funds, they would be providing that federal reporting back to the feds. We may provide some assistance as far as how to go about doing that, but they will individually be responsible for reporting to the federal government.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, what kind of an increase in workload do you think that the federal current people that are doing federal reporting will have an increase in their work with another 100 or, you know, potentially billions of dollars coming flowing into the state?
Commissioner?
Chair Kraft, Representative, I don't know that I can accurately speak to that, not knowing if how many millions to billions are coming in. It is exponentially as we go. We do have a strong grants contracts reporting team that are, like I say, working kind of around the clock right now. So if as additional funds come in, that reporting requirement does increase. However, for instance, with our low-income weatherization assistance program, part of the dollars coming from the federal government are allowed to be utilized for the reporting back to the federal government. So that is often part of the funding as it comes into play.
Thank you. So you don't believe that the reporting side to the feds will require any additional FTEs? The department will just be able to absorb that, is essentially what you're saying.
Chair Kraft, Representative, that is not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that depending on the funding source and the requirements of that particular set of funds, often the increased work can be paid for through the increased dollars from the feds. That may or may not be the case in all instances, but I'm just sharing what we have experienced with some of the ongoing federal programs.
Thank you. This I'm going to just kind of ask the fiscal staff a little bit, Mr. Chair, if that'd be okay. Do you believe that the fiscal document that you'll be creating will reflect the questions as far as, you know, because it, whether the federal, well, the money comes from the federal government or it comes from us, right? It's still an FTE created within the state of Minnesota, and we have to have an accounting for that. You know, from an average workload to all these things, we estimate that it might be 11. Will that be part of this document that's being created? Have you guys thought of that particularly? Because that's, you know, that's what we're doing here is we're trying to understand what the cost of taxpayers are going to be, and are we accurately defending it? And thanks.
So I don't believe that actually creates the document. If you'd like to comment on it, you're welcome.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so far it just lists the FTEs and what their responsibilities are.
Thank you.
Representative?
Well, I think my reasoning behind that is that we've just discovered that there's going to be additional FTEs potentially needed that won't be part of that because it's not necessarily being reported. And I don't know if, you know, this is, I mean, that's what we do here. It's a fiscal committee, and we need to make sure that things are accurate. We're just not saying, well, we'll have to just kind of take some money here and hire this fella and whatever. You know, this can be.
Representative, so. I'm not sure that's exactly what I heard. Commissioner, would you like to comment?
Chair Kraft, Representative, I am more than willing to meet offline and go through all of the details. We do within the fiscal note include components of grant writing and or the grant specialists that are needed. We have reporting components. We do have a federal requirements officer. So we have attempted to incorporate all of those needs. But I would welcome further conversation to ensure that we do it as effectively as possible.
Thanks. Okay. No further questions. Representative Garofalo.
We're in comments or questions. I was going to just speak on the bill.
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the author, thanks for bringing this bill forward today. I'll be voting yes on your bill today, notwithstanding, obviously, the well-documented fiscal problems our federal government is engaged in for paying this. But, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I would tell you that there's a lot of new members in this committee. We shouldn't be passing bills without fiscal notes. I serve on Ways and Means. I'm going to be able to see it. This is not the first time this has ever happened. There have been instances in previous sessions. But one of your jobs as chair is you are shaping new members' behavior for future legislative sessions. And I'm getting the impression that people think this is normal, that we don't know how the money's being allocated. We're hearing secondhand the number of FTEs, that this is normal and it's okay. I would just, whenever possible in the future, you have discretion as chair to accelerate or slow things down. I'm voting for your bill. I'm supporting it, okay? But we should not be doing that. As a standard practice, as a general practice, of course there are exceptions to that. I don't know how 11 FTEs can be justified for this. Again, I'm still voting for your bill, but it seems like the executive branch may be pulling a fast one in terms of funding things. My final point is that I would just encourage you on page 3 of the bill, subdivision 5, if you look at bullet point B, you will see that this bill gives extraordinary discretion. I'll just wait for you to catch up. Sorry.
What page? I'm sorry. Can you read that?
Page 3, subdivision 5. So we're at page 3, line 12, beginning okay. There. Line 12 to line 16. Mm-hmm. This is giving extraordinary discretion to the commissioner to provide 100% of the matching grant. And if you see the definition of what would trigger this 40% of the direct benefits resulting from a project awarded federal funds to be realized by a disadvantaged community, I mean, it's not a loophole. That's a Mack truck loophole that clearly the executive branch has written for maximum discretion. I would just think you should offline take a look at that and try to tighten that up. But again, I'm voting for your bill, and there's going to be some really cool things that happen with this money and things that are going to happen. So thank you.
May I just respond briefly? Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And I will just say there's nothing that we are at all trying to hide within the fiscal note. And we certainly want everyone to be able to see it and analyze it. I think that as we look at the bill, aside from the HR component, it's a pretty clear appropriation. And so while I do appreciate the details within the HR piece of it and the FTEs, we will certainly have an opportunity to talk more about that in Ways and Means. And we are certainly doing our best to have the documents available when hearings are happening. And I think we're seeing that things are happening. And I think we've heard from every person that testified today how important this is and how our local jurisdictions and utilities are feeling like we're even behind. And so I do appreciate we're trying to balance the needs of our state and our committee. So appreciate the comments and the feedback, and I certainly appreciate the support. Some really cool things will come out of this, and it is going to be good for Minnesota, whether you agree with how the money was appropriated at the federal level or not. It doesn't make sense for Minnesota to sit on the sideline.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. I have a question. I'm wondering if I could ask one of the testifiers, Daniel Lightfoot, the Intergovernmental Relations Representative from the League of Minnesota Cities, to come forward.
They left.
I think they
as you left. Okay.
No longer here.
Maybe I'll ask the question. Someone else can help me with this. But so in my committees, I'm hearing about how cities, even not just small cities, and I guess, you know, I thought it was interesting that we're considered a small city state with 700 plus cities that are less than 400 people. But even a city as big as mine, Chanhassen, which has about 26,000 people, Chaska has about 28,000 people, the cities are having a hard time accessing the grants because they realize it takes a number of hours, staff people, you know, it's complex to access the grants. Can you walk through how this will allow cities that are smaller, that don't have the staff, to benefit from these grants? Because that's, I think that's a concern that I've been hearing a lot.
Jerry.
Thank you, Representative Ream. I think that's a really good question. And I think that whether it's municipalities or utilities, accessing the money is or the opportunities or even understanding what's available is outside of their capacity of just doing what they typically do. And so that's why we went to include grant development assistance through the Department of Commerce. And so they will be able to provide technical expertise and assistance to cities, utilities, and other counties to access it. And it is overwhelming. I mean, when there's 400 different possible grant opportunities, some of them you would qualify for and some not, navigating that is going to be challenging. And I think that there are a lot of organizations or infrastructure of organizations throughout our state that can help, whether it's extension services, whether it's, you know, the clean energy resource teams. I think there will be partners who can help within our communities to bring the assistance that you're talking to.
President Reed.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. And I appreciate the question from Representative Ream and your response, Chair Akin. Coming from the seventh largest city, Minnesota, Plymouth, we also have those constraints and concerns. So it's good to know that there's assistance written into the bill to help everybody, whether it's large or small. So thank you.
Okay. Not seeing any further questions. Cherry, I'm going to give you the final comments, and then you can renew your motion.
Great. Well, I thank you for the discussion. And as we heard from the diverse group of testifiers that we had, this is a really important next step that we in Minnesota need to take. In order to address the climate crisis, in order to address our clean energy transition. So I certainly hope I can, I ask for your support. And with that, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 1656 as amended to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Akin renews her motion that House File 1656 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is referred. And with that, we are adjourned.